Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit will be Peter Salmon, and we will tackle this week's review, which we are still doing remotely, even though, breaking news, well, maybe not breaking, it's been almost a week since this news broke, but there are now movie theaters in Ontario that are open. Cineplex, which is the biggest theater chain in Canada, have opened 25 screens here in Ontario. I don't know if there was an announcement about more by the time you are hearing this, but it's not a bad start considering there are over 160 Cineplex screens in across Canada. I think that's across Canada. It's not 160 in Ontario alone, but 25 here in Ontario. Two of them I know are in the Kitchener-Waterloo area, the VIP in Kitchener and the Galaxy Cinema in Waterloo. None of the theaters here in Guelph have been announced to reopen yet, although of course that may change either by the time you are listening to this or even shortly after this comes out. We'll have to wait and see. In the meantime, we're still watching stuff at home and we're still recording from home. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new superhuman sci-fi action movie, The Old Guard, which you can now stream on Netflix, exclusively on Netflix. And that is in the back half of the show. For the first half, the last 3 weeks, we've been doing the ultimate Spielberg ranking, all of his films from the worst to the best, all 33, and I thought as a fun addendum, we would look at, for this week's show, before we get into the review, the top 10 unrealized Spielberg projects. Steven Spielberg, of course, being one of the biggest directors in Hollywood, if not the biggest director in Hollywood, has been attached to a lot of stuff over the years. Not just movies that did eventually come out, things like Memoirs of a Geisha, things like, we'll get into it in a bit, but he has been attached to various different movies over the last, let's say 50 years, rounded up, and some of them have come to fruition, others have not, some have proceeded under different filmmakers, some have stalled because they're kind of his projects and he owns the movie rights to them. Hollywood's a complicated place, so let's just put it that way. So we're going to do the top 10 of Spielberg projects that never happened, sadly. Or even happened in a different way, as we'll get to. But number 10 is The Curse of Monkey Island, and you have to be a person of a certain age to understand the awesomeness of The Curse of Monkey Island. It was a it was a video game from LucasArts, late 90s, early 2000s. It's a fun little game with pirates and treasure and monkeys. It's a lot of fun. Steven Spielberg was going to make an animated film about it. And he was teaming up with Ted Elliott, who would later go on to write the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and the National Treasure movies and a ton of different movies. I think he also was part of the Zorro script at some point. So this guy knows fun. And it turns out that a lot of the stuff that he was going to put into this Curse of Monkey Island movie did eventually end up as part of the Pirates of the Caribbean. Some of the gags and things, because, pirates are part of the Monkey Island oeuvre of games. But the Curse of Monkey Island is very much kind of like the Angry Birds of its time. It was a computer game, so it was like on your PC, even laptops weren't prevalent at that point, but it was kind of a very big game because it was, flashy, it was fun, it had a lot of really great animation in it, kind of ahead of its time. Anyway, Spielberg was going to make an animated movie out of this, and it fell through for a variety of different reasons. Number 9 is Superman. Superman was made. Richard Donner ended up making it, but apparently Steven Spielberg was the first choice. This is one of those things, because, you know, Steven Spielberg's never really made a comic book movie. Not that he's ever really had to, of course, but, you know, if there's kind of, like, one big superhero character you would think would sort of mesh well with, like, Spielberg as a person, as an artist, it would probably be Superman. The story of this, very much in the mold of Jewish mythology, you know, this Moses-like figure who is sent to drift out in space, and adopted by a kindly couple who give him the strength and the tools he needs to become a leader amongst people. Of course, it's got the sci-fi note. It's about someone who's struggling to find his place in humanity, but is essentially good and wants to do good. And I think that's very much in the Spielberg mode of thinking. So it's almost a shame he didn't get to do it. But, I mean, Superman doesn't need Spielberg, and Spielberg doesn't need Superman. It would be a marriage of convenience, and it wouldn't be very convenient for either of them, I don't think. But it's interesting to think about it. Number 8 is White Lightning. This is a movie that was made in 1973. Joseph Sargent was the director. However, the job was offered to Steven Spielberg initially. You know, it's about moonshine and crooked cops and car chases. It was made in 1973, but it would have been very interesting to see Spielberg takes something like this, which, you know, he kind of wanted to get into a bit later when you see something like 1941, where it's very comedic. Also, you know, Duel, which is pretty much a 90-minute car chase. So somewhere in between that, I think you get White Lightning. Where would Spielberg be today if he had decided to make White Lightning as opposed to making the Sugarland Express? Which probably, Sugarland probably gets that at much more thematic tones that, you know, Spielberg would play with later on, but just like for crazy comedic action stuff, what would a White Lightning Spielberg look like, and where would he be today if he had went for White Lightning over pursuing something much smaller like Sugarland Express, which would eventually take him to Jaws? He's never really been an action guy either. There has to be action in his movies, and of course there's like movies like the Indiana Jones movies, which are just blatantly action. But I feel like he had to build up his skill to get to that level, to get to 81, where he could make something really, really great in the realm of action with Indiana Jones, that first Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. Number 7 is Big, which of course was made by Penny Marshall, and of course, you know, Penny Marshall she has passed, but, you know, in terms of, like, big box office success, in terms of female directors, Penny Marshall was a first. And so, for her getting to make Big, you know, do you get A League of Their Own, if she doesn't make Big? I don't know, it's a good question. But Spielberg was apparently circling Big, which, of course, given the time period, you know, 1987, 88, he's Spielberg's already jetting off and making Color Purple, Empire of the Sun, so he's kind of already thinking about, like, different, more adult-ish directions at this point. And of course, you know, you can read a lot of interesting thematic things into the tale of a boy who wants to be an adult. And of course, Tom Hanks would become a regular, frequent contributor with Steven Spielberg, starting with Private Ryan, and then you get into Catch Me If You Can, The Terminal, Bridge of Spies. The Post, that's the last one they worked on together. But, you know, you get that very rewarding relationship coming out of that, too. Plus, Ann Spielberg, Steven Spielberg's sister, wrote the script for Big, which is kind of a weird, weird kind of trivia point. So, you know, who knows how well they might have worked with each other anyway. Number 6 is Ghost Soldiers, which is based on a book of the same name, a true story about a group of army rangers who liberate a POW camp in the Philippines during World War II. There's a lot about the brutal condition that Japanese POWs, the POWs in Japanese POW camps suffered. The Japanese were famously brutal on people that they captured in battle. So you get that. You get, you know, this kind of great escape kind of feeling with the, you know, going for broke, last-ditch effort. It was, like, near the end of the war, June 1945. It kind of feels like maybe Empire of the Sun meets The Great Escape, which would fit really nicely into Spielberg's filmography. Tom Cruise was supposed to star. I'm not really sure why this didn't happen, but it didn't. And so it is on the pile of what could have been's. Also on that pile is Why Can't I Be Audrey Hepburn, which is apparently a script written by Ryan Murphy, who people may know now as the creator of Glee and American Horror Story. He is kind of a franchise in and of himself now, but he wrote this script about Why Can't I Be Audrey Hepburn, which is about a couple who are luckless in romance, but, you know, find a lot of, I guess, synergy and a lot in common, I guess, with the works of Audrey Hepburn. Of course, famously, and this is another trivia point, Steven Spielberg worked with Audrey Hepburn on her last film, which was Steven Spielberg's Always. So he may have had some interesting insights that could have come to this. Jennifer Love Hewitt and Téa Leoni were apparently attached to star in some capacity. We know that Spielberg certainly likes to dabble in romanticism. The Terminal being an example, you know, The Terminal isn't the greatest script in the world, so if he'd get, like, a quality writer like Ryan Murphy, who knows what he might have done, but I digress. I'm running a bit out of time here, so I'm going to start trying to get through these a bit faster. Number four, I have The Haunting, but I also kind of sneak in there The Talisman and Magic. Magic is a movie that actually happened, it's Anthony Hopkins in it, but The Talisman and The Haunting, The Haunting also did happen with the end of Bond. But I find these trio interesting because Steven Spielberg, if you put Jaws aside, hasn't really done an out-and-out horror movie. And the fact that he was going to have Stephen King do the script on The Haunting, and of course The Talisman is a Stephen King property, it really boggles your mind. Here's, like, two of the biggest Stevens of pop culture circling each other in terms of looking for a project to combine their strengths and talents on, and it just doesn't happen, which is really, really sad, because there has been no great Steven Spielberg horror. Again, that's leaving Jaws aside, but there's a lot going on with Jaws in terms of, like, the family dynamic and the man versus nature motif and the adventure portions of it when they're out in the boat. I'm not sure Jaws is explicitly a horror movie. There's definitely horror elements in it. There's definitely gore in it. But wouldn't it be great to see a Steven Spielberg haunted house movie? We may never get it. Number three is Robocalypse, which is a Daniel Wilson novel. It kind of been compared to World War Z in that World War Z deals with zombies. Robocalypse deals with AIs trying to take over the world and exterminate humanity. So imagine, like, the Skynet story as told through the World War Z kind of style. This could have been really, really interesting. Chris Hemsworth and Anne Hathaway were apparently attached to star, so this got close enough that they were starting to cast it. And then Steven Spielberg ended up not making it, which is a shame. It is now in the hands of Michael Bay, and of course we've seen what Michael Bay does with robots and artificial intelligence. It's called Transformers, and he made five of them, and they get worse and worse as they go. Number two is Indiana Jones and the City of Gods, which is one of the many, many Indiana Jones 4 scripts that were ground out in the 20-some-odd-year period between Last Crusade and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. This is probably the closest to what we got with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because it brings back Marion Ravenwood, it has the army ants, it has the South American jungle adventure looking for the Fountain of Youth and all that. It doesn't have the Mutt character, though. It does not have Russians as the bad guys. It has former Nazis as the bad guys, and Steven Spielberg famously said he would no longer use Nazis in such a let's say, fun way after making Schindler's List. There was also no Saucerman in it, which is probably why George Lucas didn't like it, and why Saucermen were crammed into the final script for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. It is a shame. I would have been very interested to see what this might have looked like without the whole aliens, the ancient aliens angle of this, and to see a more straight-up Indiana Jones adventure, which we may never, which definitely won't get since Steven Spielberg has walked away from the in-development Indiana Jones 5. Number one is another combination piece, Night Skies and E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears, which are both essentially about bad aliens. In Night Skies, it's about a family that is, a farm family that is harassed by aliens. It eventually became two movies, Poltergeist and E.T., because one of the subplots of Night Skies was that there was a good alien amongst the bad ones. So Spielberg took the good alien, gave him his own movie, took the idea of a family being attacked, and turned the aliens into ghosts and made Poltergeist. E.T. 2 Nocturnal Fears was evidently going to be about a group of evil E.T.s who basically look like E.T., but albino. They come and abduct Elliot's family and torture them, and E.T. has to come and save Elliot. Spielberg, I think, wisely decided to leave that idea in the desk drawer. He said he didn't want it to rob the original's virginity, which is a difficult turn of phrase, but I know what he's getting at there. So, those are the top 10 Spielberg projects that will sadly never be. And we pour a 40 on the pavement for those, or at least a couple of them, because a couple of them did sound interesting, as I said, and I do regret we will never get the Spielberg version of The Haunting, or even Ghost Soldiers. Or even Robopocalypse, which we'll have to see what Michael Bay does with that, if anything. Alright, we're going to take a quick break for some music. We're going to come right back for our review of the week, which is The Old Guard on Netflix. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Baklava.
500, Booker.
No.
All right. All in. Here it is.
Really?
All in.
All in.
Hazelnut, not walnut. The Black Sea. Rose water. Pomegranate. Eastern Turkey.
Grazie mille, Nicky. Veramente, sei molto gentile.
Santa Maria, madre di Dio.
Prego, prego, prego.
No, 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 don't worry.
And that was a clip from The Old Guard. It is the new film from Gina Prince-Bythewood. And it stars Charlize Theron, Kiki Layne, Matthias Schoenaerts, Marwan Kenzara, Luca Marinella, Harry Melling, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. I am now being joined on the line by End Credits' own Peter Salmon for our review of the week. Peter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Just living life. Just looking forward to doing some film reviews, as per usual. That's what I live on.
Can't imagine why we would be having this Skype call if we weren't doing film reviews, but anyway, so perhaps indicating that we're maybe reaching the end of our streaming possibilities.
Yeah, maybe that's back into the CFRU room. I miss it.
Yeah. we're going to review The Old Guard, which, according to Netflix, 72 million households watched in its first weekend, available on the platform, which sounds pretty impressive, or at least it would sound pretty impressive if Netflix was a bit more open about its numbers and how it calculates success. But
was it included as part of the list where I think Bird Box was number one, and then like Murder Mystery was like four? Was it? Do you know like where it would be on that level?
Oh, in the top 10.
In the top 10? Yeah. Well, if we know the number, it would have been on that list, yeah.
Well, I think the list was sort of overall streams. The 72 million number was the first weekend. I can't remember exactly when Bright came out. I think Bright was like 90 million in the first weekend.
Yep, I remember that.
It's a little behind that, but in the same kind of relative neighborhood.
Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, Braid was pretty great. I liked it, at least. You didn't love it? Did you watch it?
I did watch it. I think Vince and I reviewed it, actually, and I don't think either of us were fans.
I'll tell you what, I think the soundtrack was phenomenal. And it got great reviews, too. I thought it was phenomenal. But yeah. No, I just hate Braid. That's okay. But yeah, no, The Old Guard did great like Braid.
That may be a question we'll have to answer in the course of this review.
Great-ish, yeah.
Okay, well, let's start with you then, and start with your sort of initial thoughts about The Old Guard and why you were down for reviewing it.
Oh, okay. Well, first off, The Old Guard, I had no idea what it was about going in. And I'm not gonna lie, if you don't, maybe go into it that way. I thought it was a pleasant surprise when it comes to its plot format. I don't think it was anything special, but I think there was enough pizzazz for it to keep my attention and for me to enjoy it. I didn't think like the action visuals were special at all, but I do think the martial arts were quite well done. I don't know. It's just like the current stage right now with other things like the Umbrella Academy. There's just a lot of real dark kind of superhero films. And I like those vibes. And I think this The Old Guard presents that in a fun way. It's kind of a resurgence, right? Like we had the two Kick-Asses, Watchmen, the Sin City, all that sort of thing. The Hellboys, like the first ones, and now we're kind of having the resurgence, Umbrella Academy, now Old Guard, and I think Old Guard, you know, it kind of fits in that realm. I would have been okay if it dived a bit more into the superhero aspects of it, but I know there were so many hints towards it becoming a sequel, right? So maybe they'll do that in the future. But yeah, I didn't think it was a special film, but I thought it was okay. I think if you like action, maybe check her out, and if you like superhero things, check her out. I got a lot of other comments, but what were your thoughts?
I did like what you just said. You didn't think it was a special film, and I'm forced to agree.
yeah
I do not think it was a special film.
I don't think it's special. I just meant when I went into it, I thought it was just going to be a straight up action. So I meant like it has some other pizzazz to it. No. Like I just listed a bunch of things that are exactly like it. And The Umbrella Academy, both as a graphic novel and a Netflix, came out first. So no, I don't think it's special. I meant it has some tendencies to it that are more special than other just basic action films. But yeah, go on. So you sounds like you're not full fan. I'm being a little generous. Like it wasn't that great, but
okay. No, it's interesting to hear you mention Umbrella Academy and I think The Old Guard feels when you kind of get to the end of The Old Guard, it feels like you just watched the pilot episode for a new Netflix show because it kind of sets everything up for like new
cooler, different adventures going
forward.
That's
in my cons. I really did not like that. And I think that action where you just assume it's going to be a sequel, so you put in a lot of hints and things towards that, I think that, you know, kills it as, you know, a work of art or whatever, you know? I think there's some exceptions, but I think for this, where it's just hinting at, oh, we're going to continue with the graphic novels and, you know, oh, one day you'll figure this out. Yeah, I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, I didn't like that either. It definitely suffers from what I call underworld-itis, where it's you get the first movie that is so prepossessed with setting up the franchise that the initial entry suffers because there's so many Easter eggs and hints and spoilers and things. And they're like, no, we realize what we have here is completely mediocre, but next time we're really going to do some stuff you're going to enjoy. And I think when you approach, I mean, obviously this is based on a series of graphic novels, so yeah, you can turn it into a franchise, but you have to be really, really careful because, you know, you do that need to make that initial chapter or that initial entry really great. You can't really leave, you know, if you have like a really good idea and you're like, I know, I'll save it for a sequel, you're automatically undermining yourself because you're already saying that I'm using the second best ideas I have. And I feel that's what's kind of all over this movie, is that it's a series of scenes made up of the second best ideas, because for the sequel, we're going to have the real grade A stuff. It's going to be, you know, the Empire Strikes Back of the Old Guard movies, and it's going to be awesome. And it's, you know, I feel like your filmmakers are automatically undermining themselves when they start thinking like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was no focus upon any of the artistic qualities or anything in like the current film. When I said like my pros, I'm not gonna lie, when I made my first comment, I was just looking at my pros page. So I still stand by. I think if you like don't mind action adventure, maybe check it out, I guess. But I don't know. You're more into that genre than me, so I think is there enough other action works on Netflix for people to just not watch this at all? Or do you think if someone's looking for kind of an action mixed with superhero thing, they should check it out?
What I think about, I'm not pleased with the result, but I think there is, if I'm doing like you and dividing things into pro and con list, I think that there is a lot going on with this movie. I think the gun-fu or the gun-kata or whatever you want to call it, that especially in that final action sequence when they're kind of like battling their way through the building.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was really good. I think like the relationships in the film, especially with the Charlize Theron character and the new immortal. We should say what this movie is about.
Oh, Natalie Freeman, Kiki Lane. Yeah.
Right. That, you know, it's... there are these four warriors led by Charlize Theron. They are immortal, and they've pretty much battling through time. They take missions that, you know, they feel that they can make a difference on, and another immortal emerges, played by, as you said, Kiki Lane. And I did like that relationship.
Yeah, I thought it was okay. I don't know.
The mentor mentee relationship.
I thought it was okay. I thought sometimes the lines were pretty pretty generic, you know? Like
no kidding.
Yeah. Like it was like kind of TV, like, well, I was gonna say CW writing, but CW's got some nice writing. But you know, more I don't know, I don't think the writing of a lot of the current DC ones are of a high quality. But yeah, it was like, I don't know, it was like a B-list kind of TV sort of dialogue writing, I guess.
Right, but I thought
it was okay. I thought it was, yeah, it was fun.
I think Charlize Theron elevates it, though.
Yeah. I didn't love the Booker. I didn't love the Booker guy, played by Matias.
Matias Schoenaerts. Yeah,
Schoenaerts. I don't really like him very much. He was kind of. It was kind of lame. I don't think he was very lovable. I didn't agree with... It was supposed to be like a surprise later that... Well, There's supposed to be a surprise later. I won't say what it is, but it's something that, like, I was kind of just thinking the whole time because I didn't agree with really anything he was saying. Like, he kept telling Niall Freeman to not, like, just let your mother and brother know you're dead. And I thought it was going to be, like, oh, that's proven wrong. She shouldn't be doing that. But that's, like, kind of how it ends. And I don't know. I didn't appreciate that. I get the point he's trying to make, but I don't know. She didn't even try to see if her rents were – not her parents and dad's. If her mom and brother were okay with it. I don't know. I thought that was weird. Maybe, like, in the sequel, they're thinking about having them as a part of it. But, yeah.
Right. I think the basic problem is that there are a lot of things in this movie that is they're kind of backwards. Because, I mean, Charlize Theron's obviously the star. And if you have Charlize Theron, obviously you're going to make her the star. But the Kiki Layne character is sort of like the point of view character who kind of, you know, we're supposed to be as the audience, she is the surrogate for which we are kind of immersed in this world because she's the noob. The problem...
Go on.
I was going to say, the problem is that we don't meet her for about 20 to 25 minutes into the film.
That's the thing. I'm not going to lie. I paid more attention after that 20 minutes once things started going. Because at first, like the first 20 minutes, I thought it was just kind of like a basic kind of action film, you know? Like I was just kind of feeling like... well, these aren't basic ones, but like I was feeling the kind of vibes of Zero Dark Thirty or like Hurt Locker, one kind of solely set in, you know, the Middle East and revolving around war. So yeah, when she was introduced, it went in a more interesting direction. But I don't know if that's a good thing because, like you said, it took 20 minutes, which is, you know,
right.
That's a lot of the film. That's like a sixth of the film, right? It was 2 hours. Is that math right?
Yeah, 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way it is. Or the way the movie has it set up is we meet all the main four immortal characters. Then we meet Niall Freeman, who's a Marine serving in the Afghan War. And she is killed, which triggers her immortality. And she heals herself. And then she meets Charlize Theron. And the way, you know... But by that point, we already know about the world of immortals, and we know about, you know, their abilities, and we have some vague idea of, like, what the setup is. And I think in a more perfect package for this movie, we meet Niall, we see her die, we see her come back to life, and we're like, oh my goodness, what the F? Because that's one of the scenes I really enjoyed, is when she's sort of walking through the Marine camp, and everyone's kind of looking at her, and everyone's kind of whispering about her, and they're kind of frightened of her, and it, like, that's, that, there's something really visceral about that I liked, and then, if you have that scene first, then you bring Charlize Theron in, and she says, oh, by the way, there are many immortals, we want you to team up with us, because we're on the run from evil pharmaceutical, evil pharma bros who want to farm our DNA or something, and then you get right into the film, instead of having this whole silly setup with the kidnapped girls that's a
trap.
I
was thinking the same thing, it made it seem like that was going to go in a much more focused direction, like, you know, she'd, I don't know, win them back, or they'd end up dying or something, but yeah, no, she was just looked down upon, and then Charlize Theron quickly came in and saved her from all those disgusting humans that can die.
Right. It has it a bit backwards too. And to get back to what you're talking about, the spoiler later on, where it turns out one of the group is a betrayer.
Ooh.
You also have this character played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's former CIA, but is kind of been tracking the team and making the connections, and is basically planning on selling them out to the pharma bro villain. I think he should have been the handler the whole time.
And that's what I was thinking. He should have been in it.
Yeah, yeah.
He should have been in it way more. It was what, like, a script out like 5 minutes. Honestly, it was not long at all. I really found him interesting too. I thought he was the one, like, it was needed. He's the human, and I think this is a needed thing to look into these immortals. Why are they immortal? Like, look into them, right? And I enjoyed that. But he was a fan of them too, so it was a fun, not, oh, they're strong, we need them. It was, you know, a look upon how important they are historically. But I would have been, again, I would have really wanted a lot more of that. What I think would have been really cool, I'm not a director, I know, but when he was kind of just giving a quick description of all the newspapers and the kind of historical lineage, I think like a quick flashback with kind of a narration of him for that would have been, I don't know, a lot of fun. It's just a longer time of him giving a good description of all that. But I know there's a lot of things in the sequels where they're probably wanting to wait and surprise people then. But still, I think it know, also, that's, again, not a good thing.
I think it also could have been a money thing where, you know, they didn't have the budget to, you know, here's the gang during the Civil War, or here's the gang during the Crusades, or here's the gang during World War II. You know, it's when you're Michael Bay and you can spend, like, you know, $10-20 million on a one scene of Transformers invading Hitler's castle or something, whatever that was in Transformers The Last Knight. But, you know, when you have a $70 million budget and, you know, you have Netflix, which is both stingy and sort of loose with their cash at the same time, it may be a bit trickier. But it's, I took that as kind of like a budgetary thing that, you know, but having said that, I did like the hints and things about the, you know, I do like that Highlander bit about like battling across time, and that's kind of cool. That's another thing I kind of liked about it. I think we just
which was the one that battled in the Highlanders?
You mean the Highlander films?
Yeah. Oh, the Highlander. I mean the Highlander one of them films. Was like fighting in the whatever those wars were called, battles.
No, I mean like Highlander battling across time. And...
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought they were. I'm in history, so yeah. I really thought it was cool. In particular, who the main character Charlize Theron, the Andromache of Scythia, because it's like it's a made up name, right? But it's based around so many things. So it just leaves a lot to the imagination. It's Hector's wife, right, in Troy, but she doesn't really have any power, so it's, you know, it's a mixture of that, and then her name also is a spelling in the Iliad of Amazonian as well, so there's that jazz, and yeah, I thought it was really cool, and Scythia is also a huge Amazonian place, so it's just a really interesting name that both has existed for thousands of years and could mean a bunch of things, but all of those things reflect upon a really strong female, and I know it was the director Gina Prince Bythewood that chose the name, so I think that's what she was thinking, and I thought that was really cool. Shittable does give a quick comment though that she was like Andromache, but not like she was very different than reflected in the Iliad and such. She just, you know, helped them all out, I guess, in that world. That's not what happened in Troy. She didn't really do much, but anyways, she was great in this, and I also thought the two that gay couple, like, that love the heck out of each other. They fought in the, what was the name of the war?
They were in the Crusades.
They were in the Crusades, yeah. And, Marwyn, well, let's see, what are their names here?
Marwyn Kenzari.
Yeah, Joe and Nikki. Yeah, and Joe was for the Islam, and Nikki was for the Christians, right? And they fought against each other, but then they found love. I don't know, I thought it was okay. I thought that was interesting.
No,
I thought it was a little kind of. It was a little. What's the term for? It should have been maybe more depth to it, where it was just kind of like we're immediately told they're gay lovers, and then they just kind of make out, and then that's their storyline. You know what I mean? There could have been more flashbacks to the development, or there could have been more. Yeah, I don't know. I guess there was other sprinkles throughout. They were just making it like, why does it need to be a super focus? It's just like a regular thing that's been existent with them. So yeah, but I don't know. I would have been okay with a bit more of their love, especially because Booker makes a comment about it later and how it's kind of had a negative effect upon him and Andromache. So I would have been okay with that, right. But like, you know. It's also something that shouldn't need to be in your face, right? It's just a natural thing. So,
I think that's it's one of my favorite aspects of the film that it's so, you know, when you think about moments like in Avengers Endgame, where you have in Captain America's sort of recovery group, you have a gay man, and then at the end of in Star Wars Rise of Skywalker, you have two women kissing in the celebration scene at the end. And Disney puts these things in these films like, look how cool we are with queerness. And it's like, it's such tepid allyship that it's kind of immediately dismissed by everyone. It's like, yeah, it's nice, but, you know, you have two male characters in Star Wars who are, you know, basically act like a bickering couple. So, on the other hand, you know, while you have this, like, yeah, this nice moment of two women kissing, you completely ignore the fact that you could easily have turned two characters into a queer relationship, and everyone would have probably been fine with that. The thing I found about
maybe I didn't focus enough on some of the kind of more small things like that. When
I
it comes
really
to
liked it a lot.
So
I
no,
I found
agree
it
with
very
your
natural.
Point of view
the Nikki and Joe relationship, it is romantic, and there's this really great scene where they have this sort of romantic speech to one another. They're allowed to be tender, and you see them, you know, spooning that in while they're encamped, and you see them spooning, and it's. Yeah, they were just allowed to be a couple. There were no bury your gays stuff, which I very much appreciated, because when they are the first two to get captured by the farmer bro, and I was like, oh god, one of them's gonna die, and it's gonna be one of those things that we get angry about when the movie plays into the trope, but it didn't happen.
And Kiki Lane, like now Freeman, right? I didn't know she was like a main character, so when she was the first to die, I was thinking the same thing, like, oh man, old guard, don't pull that kind of trope. That's not cool. Right. But no, it was the same. So, hey, maybe they did that on purpose to trick people like us.
It could be, yeah. You know, I think that was also the focus of Greg Rucka, who wrote the original graphic novel and wrote the screenplay. I think the fact that he wrote the screenplay himself was kind of a mistake. But
yeah, that's a lot of time, like Frank Miller with the spirit, it does not,
right,
does not work out.
Like comic book writing and screenplay writing, they have similarities, but they're also very, very different, because writing a comic book is episodic, and sometimes it does work in the favor. Like Scott Lobdell wrote Happy Death Day, and he wrote comics for years, particularly X-Men comics, for years and years and years. But Happy Death Day is kind of episodic, because it's, you know, when Tree dies and wakes up, and then she dies again. So it, you know, he can make the format work to his benefit as an experienced comic book writer. In the Old Guard, though, because Rucka has used to working episodically, that's how the movie feels, where it's kind of like going through the motions, and that ties back to at the end of the day, it does feel like it is the first issue of something that's going to continue, rather than a complete story with a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, I think a TV series might have been a better choice, but I know Charlize Theron, I don't think she'd ever do that, right? I don't think that's her scene. Right? Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah, I don't think she's not. No.
I mean, having said that, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon are doing TV shows now, but so you never know. But for something like this, I don't think...
I think you're going to
have
an old guard TV.
Either, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what are some other aspects of this film? We didn't talk about the good old Dudley Dursley. Good old Harry Mellon. what were your thoughts? I thought he was awesome. I thought he was really hilarious. I don't know if that was the intent, but he was cool. He was like a really, really nerdy, confident, like crazy dude who liked killing, right? They're always fun.
It's funny. I recognized him, but I didn't know from what. And I looked him up on IMDb, and I was like, oh, he's Dudley.
Yeah, he lost a lot of weight. Him and the one other, like, oh, I always forget his name.
Neville Longbottom?
Like, yeah. Yeah. Mad respect to both those two, eh?
Well, they also grew up, so
yeah, that's true.
It's you know, they're when was like the first Harry Potter movie was 2001, so that's almost 20 years ago. So they're in their 30s now. He was good as the character. I'm
he wasn't special, but I liked him.
Yeah, I'm kind of over the the Jeff Zuckerberg brand of supervillainy. I'm a super social conscious tech millionaire, but I'm also kind of evil, but I'm doing evil for good. They were clearly trying to channel Zuckerberg along with a fair amount of, I think, Martin Scorsese, because who wouldn't want to watch Martin Scorsese be thrown from a building? But
yeah, it was kind of reminding me of him too.
But I mean, Harry Melling is the actor. He's okay. But it's the trope of this particular type of character. I find kind of boring, especially when there is
a trope I enjoy. So I think that's the reason. But what he did well. For like the end when he just kept running as far away from like Charlie Stern and all the other characters as he could, but he would still be holding that like huge axe, like he was in love with it, the axe from the medieval ages or whatever. Right. And he looked so nervous, but holding like a huge axe. And I just thought that was funny.
I did love the part where he's like in the penthouse and he's like saying to the head henchman, it's like, how many more men do you have? And the henchman's like, there are no more men. I did enjoy that a bit. the thing with I understand they're trying to make a point, but I mean, again, this is another factor in this, and there's kind of a stinger scene at the end where it features the return of a character who has been teased about. And they're clearly setting up the sequel, and I was half expecting that character to be like sort of the end boss, if we're using video game parlance.
Yeah, same here. Like her flashback was so long, and it was so interesting that I thought she would end up either that or like I thought what it would be is that Dudley Dursley had found her and had himself used her
right.
to become like a part of their side. Mm-hmm. But she wasn't in it. She didn't have a line. It was just really quickly in the end. And that was kind of lame. Again, it was just one of those, there'll be a sequel thing. But there was such a flashback of her that they really gave a lot of hype for her being more of a major part near the end. That was disappointing. Although I guess it'll be cool in the sequel.
Yes. I think that's sort of the basic thinking about every creative decision is it'll be cool in the sequel. I wish there was clearly a lot of talent here. There's clearly some good ideas here. I think as we've seen a lot with studios, and maybe it points to Netflix becoming another Hollywood meat grinder, which, we could probably make the point that they've been turning into for a long time, but just this idea of, we'll throw in the ingredients. We've got a comic book property. We've got Charlize Theron. We've got, something that's ready to be turned into a sequel. People will clearly tune into this, and as fate would have it, we're still in a pandemic, and until very recently movie theaters have not been open in many places, so we've got a kind of a captive audience, and away you go. And I just want to focus on Charlize Theron too, because she is a tremendous physical performer.
That's what I was thinking. That's why I said in the beginning, like, the martial arts were great. I don't think some of the editing for the martial arts are great. Like, sometimes there would be, the first shot would be them going for a hit, and then the next shot would be, like, that hit kind of going for, like, it's the kind of shot change as if, like, a strike that's, like, a centimeter away took, like, a minute, took, like, a long time. I don't know. It just the flow between shots of little karate chops and things like that every once in a while didn't come off that great to me, but the actual full shots of her karate and such were really great. I don't know if it's karate, whatever the proper term is. My apologies.
Yeah, there. It's all right. I'm not a karate expert myself, but yellow? I'd be lucky to get a yellow belt, and especially at this point. But no, the first couple of like big action scenes take place in at least the ones that require sort of like the physical fight stuff, they're dark, and it's kind of hard to follow the action, which is why like the fight at the end where it's in this glass building in broad daylight, it feels so refreshing where it feels like they finally get the action stuff together properly. But, you know, I was thinking of Atomic Blonde, where it's, you know, all this close quarter combat, all this, you know, stunt work, wire work. I could watch Atomic Blonde every day because the fight work in that is just so bloody impressive, and she is so impressive. And if there was one thing I was kind of looking forward to the Old Guard, it's like, okay, action movie with Charlize Theron kicking everybody's ass, sign me up. And then that's kind of, even that, like, sort of bare minimum expectation is not what I was able to get. And, you know, there were a lot of great scenes of her, you know, acting in capital letters, but
yeah, she's very good at kind of showing her emotions without speaking, like kind of showing what's going on in her mind.
Right, she's a good actress for sure. But you say, here, come over here. I have an action movie with Charlize Theron playing an immortal warrior kicking everyone's butt. I better see, like, if it's a 2-hour movie, I better see like easily an hour and 90 minutes of Charlize Theron beating up guys. I don't care what you do with the other 30 minutes. I want 90 minutes of her kicking everyone's ass.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's not what I got.
No, that would have been so much fun. Like you said, the only really, like, it was really, like, they were a lot of fun at the end when you said it was more bright. But yeah, a lot of the ones, it was just too dark. For the, you know, earlier parts of the film, that it just, even, like, you know, the great punches and things weren't quite as enjoyable as they could have been.
Mm-hmm. And there's a plot twist with her character too, which sort of raises the stakes
for that really? Final fight. Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it wasn't intentional.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a bit of a missed opportunity. I don't know if there's going to be a sequel to The Old Guard, but
it's doing well. You said it got a lot of that mill, right?
Well, no, it has done well. I mean, who knows what? I mean, the economics of Netflix are as nebulous as anything. But
no, which is beautiful. It's so cool.
So who knows what'll happen? I just I hope that somebody from Netflix is listening and was taking notes.
Yeah, same here. I don't know what the reviews for it were, though. I feel like it did pretty well, didn't it? Well, this is a review, so not from us, darn it, but...
I think for the most part, reviews have been positive.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on the flip side, too, you know, if you're just looking for something fun, if you're looking for kind of like a hangover movie or a Sunday afternoon movie, you can do much worse than this. On the other hand, if you're looking for like peak Charlize Theron on par with like Mad Max or Atomic Blonde.
Well, and Monsters on Netflix.
Oh, is it?
I believe so. I've watched it. Oh, wait, you know what? No, if it's not on Netflix, it is. I know 100% it's on Crave TV. So if anybody has that, and it's great.
Okay, well, she doesn't do a lot of butt kicking in Monster, but she does a lot of good, really good acting in Monster.
I don't know. She kind of does a lot of, like, maybe not butt kicking, but she does a lot of what butt kicking results in, right? Except to an even worse degree. But yeah, no, I know what you mean.
She does take out a lot of guys in that movie. Let's just say that. Okay, Peter, if people want to talk to you some more on the internet, how can they find you?
As per usual, Mr. Towerak, YouTube, and good old Twitter. One day TikTok. I'm trying to get the one Mr. Towerak guy to do that, and he doesn't want to. He hates it, which I get. I don't love it, but, you know, maybe one day. But yeah, Twitter and the YouTube.
And maybe stay tuned for TikTok if that gets
worked out. Yeah, stay tuned. Stay tuned.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you'd like to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my news and politics site, Guelph Politico, at guelphpolitico.ca. or you can read my writings about horror movies over at Nightmare on Film Street, which you can find at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. You'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for an all-new episode of End Credits, and we will see you then.